Chapter 63. That Silly Old Dollar Sign. Roosevelt returned to Washington on Monday, December 16th, looking tanned and exuberant and jaunty, according to his speechwriter Robert E. Sherwood, a playwright and screenwriter. The president convened a press conference the next day, smoking a cigarette as he greeted reporters. Mischievous as always with the press, he told them, "I don't think there is any particular news," and then proceeded to introduce the idea that had come to him aboard the Tuscaloosa, which historians would later judge to be one of the most important developments of the war. He began, "There is absolutely no doubt in the mind of a very overwhelming number of Americans that the best immediate defense of the United States is the success of Britain in defending itself. Now, what I am trying to do is eliminate the dollar sign. That is something brand new in the thoughts of everybody in this room, I think. Get rid of the silly, foolish old dollar sign." "Well, let me give you an illustration," he said, and then deployed an analogy that distilled his idea into something both familiar and easy to grasp, something that would resonate with the quotidian experience of countless Americans. "Suppose my neighbor's home catches fire, and I have got a length of garden hose 400 or 500 feet away. But, my heaven, if he can take my garden hose and connect it up with his hydrant, I may help him put out the fire. Now what do I do? I don't say to him before that operation, 'Neighbor, my garden hose cost me $15. You have got to pay me $15 for it.' What is the transaction that goes on? I don't want $15. I want my garden hose back after the fire is over. All right. If it goes through the fire, all right, intact, without any damage to it, he gives it back to me and thanks me very much for the use of it. But suppose it gets smashed up, holes in it, during the fire. We don't have too much formality about it, but I say to him, 'I was glad to lend you that hose. I see I can't use it anymore. It's all smashed up.' He says, 'How many feet of it were there?' I tell him there were 150 feet of it. He says, 'All right, I will replace it.'" That became the kernel of an act introduced in Congress soon afterward, numbered H.R. 1776, and titled "A Bill Further to Promote the Defense of the United States and for Other Purposes," soon to receive its lasting byname, the Lend-Lease Act. Central to the proposal was the idea that it was in the best interests of the United States to provide Britain, or any ally, with all the aid it needed, whether it could pay or not. The bill immediately met pitched resistance from senators and congressmen who believed it would bring America into the war, or, as one opponent vividly predicted, also deploying an analogy that would resonate in America's heartland, that it would result in plowing under every fourth American boy. The remark infuriated Roosevelt, who called it the most untruthful, the most dastardly, unpatriotic thing that has been said in public life in my generation. That Roosevelt's idea would ever be more than an idea was, by Christmas 1940, anything but certain. Harry Hopkins grew curious about Churchill. According to Sherwood, the eloquent power of the Prime Minister's letter to Roosevelt sparked in Hopkins a desire to get to know Churchill and to find out how much of him was mere grandiloquence and how much of him was hard fact. Hopkins soon would get that chance, and in the process, despite his ill health and fragile frame, shape the future course of the war, while spending much of his time freezing to death in bomb-torn London. Chapter 64. A Toad at the Gate. With Churchill's courtship of Roosevelt in so sensitive a phase, choosing an ambassador to replace Lord Lothian became a critical matter. His craftier instincts told him that Lothian's death might, in fact, offer him an opportunity to strengthen his hold on his own government. Banishing men to far-flung posts was, for Churchill, a familiar and effective tactic for muting political dissent. Two men stood out as potential sources of future opposition: former Prime Minister Lloyd George and Churchill's Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax. They also ran for his own job. That his first choice among the two men was Lloyd George suggests that he saw him as the more immediate and serious threat. Churchill sent Lord Beaverbrook as intermediary to offer him the post. This was awkward for Beaverbrook, because he himself would have liked to be made U.S. ambassador, but Churchill believed he was too valuable an asset, both as Minister of Aircraft Production and as a friend, confidant, and advisor. Lloyd George declined the offer, citing his doctor's concerns about his health. He was, after all, 77 years old. The next day, Tuesday, December 17th, Churchill again summoned Beaverbrook, this time to discuss the possibility of sending Halifax to Washington, and he again dispatched Beaverbrook to make the offer, or at least propose the idea. What Churchill clearly knew from their long friendship was that Beaverbrook had a knack for, and delighted in, making people do what he wanted them to do. Halifax biographer Andrew Roberts called Beaverbrook a born schemer. Beaverbrook's own biographer, A.J.P. Taylor, wrote, "There was nothing Beaverbrook liked better in politics than moving men about from one office to another, or in speculating how to do it." Offering the job to Halifax required a certain brutality. By any standard, the post was a demotion, no matter how important it was that Britain win America's eventual participation in the war. But Churchill also knew well that if his own government faltered, the King would likely turn to Halifax to replace him, having favoured Halifax initially. Which was precisely why Churchill decided that Halifax should go, and why he sent Beaverbrook to propose that he do so. On Tuesday, December 17th, after doing a broadcast at the BBC, Beaverbrook made his way to the Foreign Office to meet with Halifax, who was immediately on his guard. He knew that Beaverbrook lived for intrigue, and that he had been waging a war of whispers against him. Beaverbrook offered him the job on Churchill's behalf. In his diary that Tuesday night, Halifax expressed uncertainty as to whether Churchill really thought he was the best choice, or merely wanted to get him out of the Foreign Office, out of London. Halifax did not want to go, and told Beaverbrook as much. But Beaverbrook reported back to Churchill that Halifax had replied with an unhesitant yes. Wrote biographer Roberts, "He returned to Churchill with a completely fabricated story about Halifax's reaction to the offer." Churchill and Halifax met at 11:40 the next morning on an unrelated matter, during which Halifax explained his reluctance. He did so again the next day, Thursday, December 19th. The conversation was a tense one. Halifax tried to persuade Churchill that sending a foreign secretary to Washington as an ambassador might appear to be an act of desperation, of trying too hard to please Roosevelt. Halifax returned to the Foreign Office feeling that he had succeeded in sidestepping the appointment. He was, however, mistaken. With the coming of winter, the immediate threat of invasion diminished, though no one doubted this was only a temporary easement. Now another, more amorphous danger took its place. As the Luftwaffe expanded its attacks and sought to replicate the Coventry raid in attacks on other British cities, the matter of morale rose to the fore. London had thus far proven resilient, but London was an immense city, immune to the Luftwaffe's new obliterative tactics. Would the rest of the country prove as tough if more cities experienced Coventration? The attack on Coventry had shaken that city to the core, causing morale to falter. Home intelligence observed that the shock effect was greater in Coventry than in the East End of London, or any other bombed area previously studied. A pair of subsequent raids on Southampton, also intense, likewise shattered the public psyche. The Bishop of Winchester, whose diocese included the city, observed that people were broken in spirit after the sleepless and awful nights. "Everyone who can do so is leaving the town." Each night, hundreds of residents vacated the city and slept in their cars in open country before returning to work the next day. For the time, the bishop reported, morale has collapsed. After a series of raids on Birmingham, the city's American consul wrote to his superiors in London that while he had seen no sign of disloyalty or defeatism among residents, to say that their mental health is not being undermined by bombing is to talk nonsense. These new attacks threatened to bring about the wholesale collapse of national morale that defence planners long had feared, and to so intensify public dismay as to threaten Churchill's government. The arrival of winter made the matter even more acute, for it multiplied the daily hardships imposed by the German air campaign. Winter brought rain, snow, cold, and wind. Asked by mass observation to keep track of the factors that most depressed them, people replied that weather topped the list. Rain dripped through roofs pierced by shrapnel, wind tore past broken windows. There was no glass to repair them. Frequent interruptions in the supply of electricity, fuel, and water left homes without heat and their residents without a means of getting clean each day. People still had to get to work. Their children still needed to go to school. Bombs knocked out telephone service for days on end. What most disrupted their lives, however, was the blackout. It made everything harder, especially now in winter, when England's northern latitude brought the usual expansion of night. Every December, Mass Observation also asked its panel of diarists to send in a ranked list of the inconveniences caused by the bombings that most bothered them. The blackout invariably ranked first, with transport second, though these two factors were often linked. Bomb damage turned simple commutes into hours-long ordeals and forced workers to get up even earlier in the darkness, where they stumbled around by candlelight to prepare for work. Workers raced home at the end of the day to darken their windows before the designated start of the nightly blackout period, a wholly new class of chore. It took time, an estimated half-hour each evening, more if you had a lot of windows, and depending on how you went about it. The blackout made the Christmas season even bleaker. Christmas lights were banned. Churches with windows that could not easily be darkened cancelled their night services. The blackout also imposed new dangers. People routinely crashed into lampposts or rode their bikes into obstacles. Cities used white paint to try to ameliorate the most obvious problems, applying it to curbs, steps, and the running boards and bumpers of cars. Trees and lampposts received rings of white paint, and the police enforced special blackout speed limits, issuing 5,935 tickets in the course of the year. But people still drove into walls and tripped over obstacles and stumbled into one another. Dr. Jones, the air intelligence man who'd discovered Germany's secret beams, discovered the value of white paint, or rather the dangers of its absence. When driving to London one night after giving a lecture at Bletchley Park, he crashed into a truck left standing in the road. The rear end had been painted white, but the paint was now obscured by mud. Jones was driving at only 15 miles an hour, but he still went hurtling through the windshield and lacerated his forehead. Authorities in Liverpool implicated the blackout in the deaths of 15 dock workers who died by drowning. But the blackout also was a vector for humour. Blackout material used on train windows became a scribbling pad, wrote Mass Observation diarist Olivia Cockett. She noted how someone had altered the notice, "Blinds must be kept down after dark," to "Blondes must be kept down after dark," which was subsequently amended to "Knickers must be kept down after dark." For a degree of relief from the blackout and the other new burdens of life, Cockett turned to smoking. "One new habit since the war. Enjoying cigarettes," she wrote. "Used to smoke occasionally, but now three or four a day regularly, and with pleasure. Inhaling makes the difference, and the nicotine treat, which just detaches one's mind from one's body for a second or two after each breath." The greatest threat to morale in London was deemed to arise from the tens of thousands of citizens bombed out of their homes, or otherwise compelled to use public shelters, where conditions within were drawing widespread condemnation. The mounting outcry prompted Clementine Churchill to venture into the shelters to see them for herself, often accompanied by John Colville. She began visiting what she believed to be a fairly representative cross-section of shelters. On Thursday, December 19th, for example, she toured shelters in Bermondsey, an industrial district that in the preceding century had housed the notorious slum, Jacob's Island, where Charles Dickens, in Oliver Twist, had killed off the malignant Bill Sykes. What Clementine found repulsed her. The occupants of shelter spent perhaps 14 hours out of the 24 in really horrible conditions of cold, wet, dirt, darkness and stench, she wrote in notes to her husband. The worst shelters escaped reform because officials judged them so awful as to be beyond redemption, but too necessary to close immediately. As a consequence, Clementine found they just grew worse. One object of her ire was the way in which shelters, trying to adapt to night bombing by installing permanent sleeping accommodations, tried to cram as many beds as possible into the allocated space by stacking bunks in threes. "The more one sees of the three-tier bunks," Clementine wrote, "the worse one feels them to be. They are, of course, much too narrow. An extra 6 inches would have made all the difference between great discomfort and comparative comfort." The bunks were also too short. Feet touched feet. Feet touched heads. Heads touched heads. In the case of heads touching, there is a great danger of lice spreading, Clementine wrote. And lice posed a serious problem. Although lice were to be expected, war entails lice, she wrote. Their presence raised the potential for outbreaks of typhus and trench fever, both louse-borne diseases. It seems that if these started, they would rage through the poorer population of London like wildfire, she noted. If there was tremendous mortality among the workers, war output would be seriously diminished. By far the worst trait of the three-tier bunk, as Clementine saw it, was the limited vertical space between tiers. I wonder people do not die for lack of air, she wrote. Where mothers have their babies sleeping with them, it must be quite intolerable, as the baby has to sleep on top of the mother, as the bunk is too narrow for it to sleep by her side. She feared that many more three-tiered bunks had been ordered and asked Churchill if these orders could be stopped until the bunks were redesigned. As to the bunks already installed, the solution, she argued, was simply to remove the middle tier. Doing so, she noted, would have the satisfactory effect of reducing the number of people crowding the worst shelters by one-third. Her greatest concern was sanitation. She was horrified to find that there were very few toilets in shelters, and that overall, sanitation conditions were abysmal. Her reports revealed not just a willingness to venture into unaccustomed realms, but an eye for Dickensian detail. The latrines, she wrote, are often among the bunks, and have skimpy canvas curtains which do not cover the opening. These curtains are often foul at the bottom. The latrines should be away from the bunks, and the entrances turned to a wall so as to ensure a little privacy. The worst conditions she encountered were on Philpott Street, at the Whitechapel Synagogue, where people were sleeping absolutely opposite the latrines, with their feet almost inside the canvas curtains, and where the stench was intolerable. She recommended that the number of latrines be doubled or tripled. This is easy, she noted, as they are mostly buckets. She observed that these were often placed on porous ground, into which waste seeped and accumulated. One solution, she wrote, would be to place these on big sheets of tin with turned-up edges like trays. These tin trays could be washed. Separate latrines should be installed for children, with shorter buckets, she wrote. The ordinary buckets are too high for them. And, she found, the buckets received little attention. The buckets should, of course, be emptied before they are full, but in some places, I am told, this is done only once in 24 hours, which is not soon enough. She was especially appalled to find that latrines were often unlit. The prevailing darkness merely hides and, of course, encourages the dirty conditions. The winter rain and cold had made bad conditions worse. In her tours of shelters, she found water dripping through the roof and seeping through the walls and floors. She reported hearing examples of earthen floors turned to mud and water accumulating to such a degree that it needed to be removed with pumps. She isolated another problem. Most shelters had no provision for making tea. For this purpose, she wrote, the minimum requirement would be an electric power plug and a boiler. She told Churchill that she believed the problem with the worst shelters was that responsibility for them was apportioned among too many agencies with overlapping authority, and as a result, nothing was done. The only way to get the matter straightened out is to have one authority for safety, health, and everything else, she wrote, in a brief minute, in which she addressed her husband not as Winston but as Prime Minister. Division of authority is what is preventing improvement. Her investigations had an effect. Churchill, aware that how the public felt about shelters would influence how they viewed his government, made shelter reform a priority for the coming year. In a minute to his Minister of Health and his Home Secretary, he wrote, "Now is the time to begin a radical improvement in the shelters, so that by next winter there may be more safety, more comfort, warmth, light and amenities for all who use them." That the shelters would still be needed at the end of 1941 was, to Churchill, a certainty. On Friday morning, December 20th, Halifax's Under-Secretary, Alexander Cadogan, picked him up at the Foreign Office, and together they went to Westminster Abbey to attend a memorial service for Lord Lothian. Cadogan noted in his diary that Halifax's wife was already seated, and clearly unhappy. "Furious," he wrote. She vowed to talk to Churchill herself. After the service, she and her husband set off for number 10. Barely banking her anger, Dorothy told Churchill that if he sent her husband to America, he would lose a loyal colleague who could marshal strong allies to support him should a political crisis arise. She suspected the hand of Beaverbrook. Halifax, looking on with bemusement, wrote that Churchill could not have been kinder, but he and Dorothy were certainly talking a different language. Halifax later wrote to former Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin, "You can guess how mixed my feelings are. I don't think it is particularly my line of country, and I have never liked Americans, except odd ones. In the mass, I have always thought them dreadful." By Monday, December 23rd, the deal was done. The assignment announced, Halifax's replacement as Foreign Secretary chosen. Anthony Eden would succeed him. At a noon cabinet meeting, Churchill spoke of his gratitude to Halifax for taking on so vital a mission. Cadogan was present as well. I looked up and saw the Beaver opposite me, hugging himself, beaming and almost winking. The King sought to console Halifax when Halifax paid him a visit at Windsor Castle on Christmas Eve. He was very unhappy at the thought of leaving here now, and was perplexed at what might happen if anything happened to Winston, the King wrote in his diary. The team was not a strong one without a leader, and there were some hotheads among it. I told him he could always be recalled. By way of helping him, I suggested that the post of my ambassador in USA was more important at this moment than the post of Foreign Secretary here. This was scant relief for Halifax, who by now understood not only that his removal as Foreign Secretary was recompense for his being perceived to be a likely successor to Churchill, but also that the engineer behind the plan's execution was, indeed, to use his favoured nickname for Beaverbrook, the Toad. Chapter 65. Weihnachten. Churchill's resilience continued to perplex German leaders. "When will that creature Churchill finally surrender?" wrote propaganda chief Joseph Goebbels in his diary, after noting the latest Coventry-style attack against Southampton and the sinking of another 50,000 tons of Allied shipping. "England cannot hold out forever." He vowed that air raids would continue until England falls on her knees and begs for peace. But England seemed far from doing so. The RAF made a succession of raids against targets in Italy and Germany, among them an attack against Mannheim by more than 100 bombers that killed 34 people and destroyed or damaged some 500 structures. This was the Operation Abigail raid in retaliation for Coventry. The raid itself was not particularly troubling to Goebbels, who called it easily bearable. What he found disconcerting, however, was the fact that England still felt confident enough to conduct the raid at all, and that the RAF was able to muster so many aircraft. Bombers also struck Berlin, prompting Goebbels to write, "It seems that the English have found their touch again." But now it was more vital than ever that Churchill somehow be made to exit the war. On December 18th, Hitler issued Directive No. 21, Case Barbarossa, his formal order to his generals to begin planning for an invasion of Russia. The directive began, "The German armed forces must be prepared, even before the conclusion of the war against England, to crush Soviet Russia in a rapid campaign." The italics were Hitler's. The directive detailed the roles to be played by the German army, air force, and navy, especially the army's armoured units, and envisioned the occupation of Leningrad and Kronstadt, as well as eventually Moscow. "The bulk of the Russian army stationed in Western Russia will be destroyed by daring operations led by deeply penetrating armoured spearheads." Hitler directed his commanders to produce plans and timetables. It was crucial that the campaign begin soon. The longer Germany delayed, the more time Russia would have to build up its army and air force, and England to recoup its strength. German forces were to be ready by May 15th, 1941. "It is of decisive importance," the directive said, "that our intention to attack should not be known." During these preparations, the Luftwaffe was to continue its attacks against England without restraint. Goebbels, meanwhile, fretted about moral decay. In addition to guiding Germany's propaganda program, he served as Minister of Popular Culture. and saw it as his mission to vanquish forces that threatened to undermine public morality. No strip dancers are to perform in rural areas, in small towns, or in front of soldiers, he told the staff at one of his December propaganda meetings. He called on his assistant, Leopold Guttere, a baby-faced 39-year-old, to compose a circular addressed to all compères, masters of ceremonies at cabarets and the like. The circular is to be in the form of a categorical final warning forbidding compères to make political wisecracks or to use lewd erotic jokes in their performances. Goebbels also brooded about Christmas. Germans loved Christmas, Weihnachten, more than any other holiday. They sold Christmas trees on every corner, sang carols, danced, and drank to excess. He warned his lieutenants against the creation of a sentimental Christmas atmosphere and condemned the blubbing and mourning that Christian holidays induced. It was unsoldierly and un-German, he said, and must not be allowed to extend through the whole period of Advent. This must be confined exclusively to Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, he told the group. And even then, he said, Christmas was to be framed in the context of the war. A sloppy Christmas tree atmosphere lasting several weeks is out of tune with the militant mood of the German people. At his own home, however, Goebbels found himself increasingly mired, not unhappily, in preparations for the holiday. He and his wife, Magda, had six children, all of whose names began with H, Helga, Hildegard, Helmut, Huldina, Hedwig, and Heidrun, the last just a month and a half old. The couple also had an older son, Harald, from Magda's previous marriage. The children were excited, as was Magda, who thinks about nothing but Christmas, Goebbels wrote. Diary, December 11th. A lot of work with the Christmas parcels and gifts. I have to distribute them to the 120,000 soldiers and flak gunners in Berlin alone. But I enjoy it. And then the host of personal commitments. These are increasing from year to year. December 13th. Choose Christmas gifts. Make Christmas arrangements along with Magda. The children are sweet. Unfortunately, one or the other of them is always ill. On December 22nd, two RAF air raids drove the family into a shelter until 7 a.m. Not pleasant with all the children, some of whom are still sick, Goebbels wrote. Only 2 hours sleep. I am so tired. Not too tired, however, to muse upon his favourite pastime. A Jew law has been passed by the Sobrania, Bulgaria's parliament, he wrote. Not a radical measure, but, nevertheless, something. Our ideas are on the march throughout the whole of Europe, even without compulsion. The next day, RAF bombers killed 45 Berliners. So considerable losses, after all, Goebbels wrote on Christmas Eve. He authorized Christmas bonuses for his colleagues. They must have some sort of compensation for all their work and their ceaseless dedication. With Russia now in Hitler's sights, Deputy Rudolf Hess was more anxious than ever to engineer a settlement with England and fulfil the wish of his Führer. He still had not received a response from the Duke of Hamilton in Scotland, but continued to see the Duke as a source of hope. An idea came to Hess, and now, December 21st, his plane stood ready at the Augsburg airfield of the Messerschmitt Works near Munich, even though more than 2 feet of snow lay on the ground. The aircraft was a Messerschmitt ME-110, a twin-engine fighter bomber modified for long-distance flying. Ordinarily it carried 2 men, but it could easily be flown solo. Hess was an accomplished pilot. Nevertheless, he had needed to learn the peculiarities of the ME-110 and took lessons with an instructor. After proving himself capable, he was given exclusive use of a brand new model, a privilege accorded him because he was, after all, Hitler's deputy, and, depending on perspective, either the second or third most powerful man in the Third Reich. Power had its limits, however. Hess's first choice of aircraft, a single-engine ME-109, was denied. He kept his new plane at the Augsburg airfield and flew it often. No one questioned, at least not openly, why so senior an official would want to do so, nor why he kept requesting additional modifications to the aircraft that would increase its range, nor why he kept asking his secretary to get him the latest aviation weather forecasts for the British Isles. He acquired a map of Scotland and mounted it on the wall of his bedroom, so that he could memorize prominent elements of the terrain. He delineated a mountainous zone in red. Now, on December 21st, with the runway cleared of snow, Hess took off. 3 hours later, he was back. At some point during the flight, his emergency flare pistol had become entangled in the cables that controlled the plane's vertical stabilizers, the two upright fins at the rear of the fuselage causing them to jam. That he was able to land at all, and in such snowy conditions, was a testament to his skill as a pilot. Chapter 66 Rumours. As Christmas neared, rumours flourished. Air raids and the threat of invasion left fertile ground for the propagation of false tales. To combat them, the Ministry of Information operated an anti-lies bureau for countering German propaganda and an anti-rumours bureau for dealing with rumours of local origin. Some were detected by the Postal Censorship Bureau, which read people's mail and listened in on telephone conversations. Managers of bookstalls owned by W.H. Smith reported rumours as well. Anyone spreading false stories could be fined or, in egregious cases, imprisoned. The rumours covered a broad range. In the Orkney Islands, the Shetlands, Dover and elsewhere, intercepted letters reported that thousands of bodies had washed ashore after a failed invasion attempt. This rumour was particularly persistent. German parachute troops, dressed as women, were said to have landed in Leicestershire, in the Midlands, and Skegness, on the North Sea coast. This proved not to be true. German planes were believed to be dropping poison cobwebs. This rumour is rapidly dying, Home Intelligence reported. A rumour circulating in Wimbledon held that the enemy is preparing to use a high-explosive bomb of terrifying dimensions, which is destined to wipe the suburb off the map. Wrote one official, "I am seriously informed that it has taken an unhealthy grip on Wimbledonian imagination. No such bomb existed." A particularly gruesome and common rumour in circulation during the week before Christmas held that large numbers of corpses in bombed public shelters are to remain there, the shelters being bricked up to form communal catafalques. This rumour proved stubborn as well, reincarnated afresh after each new air raid. Chapter 67 Christmas. Christmas was on everyone's mind. The holiday was important for morale. Churchill decided that the RAF would not conduct bombing operations against Germany on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, unless the Luftwaffe attacked England first. Colville found himself saddled with addressing the vexed question, raised in the House of Commons, of whether the custom of ringing church bells on Christmas should be suspended, owing to the fact that church bells were the designated warning that invasion was underway. At first, Churchill recommended that the bells be rung. He changed his mind after talking with his Home Forces commander, General Brooke. Colville by then had prepared what he considered to be a strong argument for ringing the bells. But now he backed off, noting in his diary that the thought of the responsibility that would be mine if any disaster occurred on Christmas Day made me pause. Colville and his fellow private secretaries, having worked a succession of 2 a.m. nights, hoped to have a week off for the holiday. Principal Secretary Eric Seal crafted a delicately phrased minute, asking permission. The request incensed Churchill, according to Colville. Scrooge-like, Churchill scrawled "No" on the document itself. He told Seal that his own plan for the holiday, which fell on a Wednesday, was to spend it either at Chequers or in London, working continuously. He hoped, he wrote, that the recess may be used not only for overtaking arrears, but for tackling new problems in greater detail. He did, however, concede that each member of his staff could have 1 week off between then and March 31st, provided the weeks were well spread. On Christmas Eve, in the afternoon, he signed copies of his own books to distribute as gifts to Colville and the other secretaries. He also sent Christmas presents to the King and Queen. He gave the King a siren suit like his own, the Queen a copy of Henry Watson Fowler's famous 1926 Guide to the English Language, a dictionary of modern English usage. The private secretaries, meanwhile, scrambled to find something that would make a suitable gift for Churchill's wife. Despite the war and the threat of air raids, London's commercial streets were crowded, even though stores were meagerly stocked. Wrote American Observer General Lee in his diary, "There may not be a great deal in the shops, and there may be a great many people out of London, but to try to buy anything today was like swimming against Niagara. The streets were packed with traffic, both foot and motor." The secretaries first considered getting flowers for Clementine, but they found that the flower vendors had only sparse inventory and nothing suitable. "Apparently," wrote John Martin in his diary, "those bowls of hyacinths that used to appear at Christmas were Dutch, and Holland was now firmly under German control." Their thoughts turned next to chocolate. Here, too, the big stores had been mostly denuded, but in the end we found one that could produce a large box. It doubtless helped that the intended recipient was the wife of the Prime Minister. Churchill left for Chequers, calling out as he made his exit, "A busy Christmas and a frantic New Year!" It was, of course, on Christmas Eve, with snow falling and the night skies quiet, that Colville first heard a rumour that his beloved gay Margesson had become engaged to Nicholas Nico Henderson, who, decades later, would become Britain's ambassador to America. Colville pretended not to care, but it gave me a pang and worries me, even though I am fairly confident Gay will take no sudden leap. She is much too indecisive. He could not understand why he persisted in loving Gay, with so little likelihood that she would ever return his affections. So often I despise her for her weakness of character, unobservancy, selfishness, and inclination to moral and mental defeatism. Then I tell myself it is all selfishness on my part, that I find faults in her as a cover for her lack of interest in me, that instead of trying to help her, as I should if I really loved her, I seek relief for my feelings in bitterness or contempt. He added, "I wish I understood the true state of my feelings." There was something about Gay that made her different from every other woman he knew. "I sometimes think I should like to marry, but how can I even think of it when the possibility of my marrying Gay, however distant, remains in being? Only time can solve this problem, and patience." That night, late, Lord Beaverbrook discovered that one of his most valued men was still in his office. The man had been working 6 or 7 days a week, arriving in the morning before sunup, leaving well after nightfall, remaining at his desk even after sirens warned of imminent attack. And here it was, Christmas Eve. At length, the man got up and left his office to go to the washroom before departing for the night. When the man returned, there was a small package on his desk. He opened it and found a necklace. There was also a note from Beaverbrook. "I know what your wife must be feeling. Please give her this with my regards. It belonged to my wife." He'd signed it B. For Mary Churchill, this was a Christmas of unexpected and unparalleled joy. The entire family, even Nelson the cat, gathered at Chequers, most arriving on Christmas Eve. Sarah Churchill's husband, Vic Oliver, whom Churchill disliked, also came. For once, there were no official visitors. The house was warmed by holiday decorations. "The great gloomy hall glowed with the lighted, decorated tree," Mary wrote in her diary. "Fires burned from every grate. Soldiers patrolled the grounds with rifles and bayonets, breathing steam into the cold night air, and aircraft spotters stood freezing on the roof. But otherwise the ward had gone quiet, with Christmas Eve and Christmas Day devoid of air or sea battles. On Christmas morning, Churchill had breakfast in bed, with Nelson lounging on the bedclothes as he worked through the papers in his regular black box and in his yellow box of secrets, dictating replies and comments to a typist. "The Prime Minister has made a great point of working as usual over the holiday," wrote John Martin, the private secretary on duty at Chequers that weekend. "And yesterday morning was like almost any other here, with the usual letters and telephone calls, and, of course, many Christmas greeting messages thrown in." Churchill gave him a signed copy of his own Great Contemporaries, a collection of essays about 2 dozen famous men, including Hitler, Leon Trotsky, and Franklin Roosevelt, this last entitled Roosevelt from Afar. "From lunchtime on, less work was done, and we had a festive family Christmas," wrote Martin, who was treated as if he were a member of the family. "Lunch centered on a ration times luxury, an immense turkey. The largest turkey I have ever seen," Martin wrote, sent from the farm of Churchill's late friend Harold Harmsworth. The newspaper magnate had died a month before, and among his last wishes had directed the bird's final disposition. Lloyd George sent apples picked from the orchards at his estate, Bronny Dee, in Surrey, where, in addition to growing Bramleys and Cox's orange pippins, he cultivated his long-standing love affair with his personal secretary, Francis Stevenson. The family listened to the King's Royal Christmas Message, an annual custom broadcast over the radio since 1932. The King spoke slowly, clearly fighting the speech impediment that long had harried him, for example, a strangled start to the word unstinted, followed by its perfect execution, but this added to the gravity of his message. In the last great war, the flower of our youth was destroyed, he said, and the rest of the people saw but little of the battle. This time we are all in the front lines and in danger together. He predicted victory and invited his audience to look forward to a time when Christmas days are happy again. And now the fun began. Vic Oliver sat down at the piano. Sarah sang. A cheery dinner followed, and after this came more music. Champagne and wine put Churchill in a buoyant mood. For once the shorthand writer was dismissed, wrote John Martin, and we had a sort of sing-song until after midnight. The PM sang lustily, if not always in tune, and when Vic played Viennese waltzes, he danced a remarkably frisky measure of his own in the middle of the room. All the while, Churchill held forth, expounding on this and that until 2 in the morning. This was one of the happiest Christmases I can remember, Mary wrote in her diary late that night in the prison room, despite all the terrible events going on around us. It was not happy in a flamboyant way, but I've never before seen the family look so happy, so united, so sweet. We were complete, Randolph and Vic having arrived this morning. I have never felt the Christmas feeling so strongly. Everyone was kind, lovely, gay. I wonder if we will all be together next Christmas. I pray we may. I pray also next year it may be happier for more people. The unofficial Christmas truce held. Heilige Nacht, in truth, stille Nacht, John Martins wrote, holy night, silent night, calling this a relief and rather touching. In Germany and England no bombs fell, and families everywhere were reminded of how things once had been, except for the fact that no church bells rang and a great many Christmas tables had empty chairs. In London, Harold Nicholson, of the Ministry of Information, spent Christmas Day alone, his wife safely lodged at their country home. The gloomiest Christmas day that I have yet spent, he wrote in his diary. I get up early and have little work to do. He read various memoranda and had lunch by himself, during which he read a book, The War Speeches of William Pitt the Younger, published in 1915. Later he met his friend and sometime lover, Raymond Mortimer, at the Ritz Bar, after which the two dined at Prunier, the famed French restaurant. At the day's end, Nicholson attended a ministry party, which included the showing of a movie. He returned to his Bloomsbury flat through a landscape made desolate by previous bombs and fires and melting snow, the night extraordinarily dark because of the blackout and the absence of moonlight, a new moon due in 3 days. Poor old London is beginning to look very drab, he wrote. Paris is so young and gay that she could stand a little battering, but London is a charwoman among capitals, and when her teeth begin to fall out, she looks ill indeed. And yet, in places, the city still managed to raise a good deal of Christmas cheer. As one diarist noted, the pubs are all full of happy, drunken people singing Tipperary, and the latest army song, which goes, "Cheer up, my lads, fuck 'em all." Chapter 68 Egg Layer. On Friday, December 27, 1940, the Admiralty conducted its first full-scale test of the Prof's aerial mines, a new iteration that involved small bombs carried aloft by balloons. The balloons, 900 of them, were readied for launch as German planes approached. Officials gave the signal for their release. No balloons rose. The release team did not receive the message to launch for half an hour. What followed was no more encouraging. About a third of the 900-odd balloons inflated proved defective, wrote Basil Collier, the air war historian. Others exploded early in their flight or descended prematurely in unexpected places. No bombers appeared. The test was suspended 2 hours later. Still, Churchill and the Prof were not deterred. They insisted that the mines were not merely viable, but crucial to air defence. Churchill ordered more mines produced, more trials conducted. By now, presumably with no intent at humour, the mines programme had been assigned the official codename Egglayer. Work proceeded as well on improving the RAF's ability to locate the Luftwaffe's beams and jam or mask them, but German engineers kept devising new variants and transmission patterns and building more transmitters. German pilots, meanwhile, were growing uneasy about the possibility that the RAF might use the same beams to locate their bombers and set up an aerial ambush. They gave the RAF too much credit. Despite refinements of air-to-air radar and tactics, Fighter Command was still effectively blind after dark. Chapter 69. Auld Lang Syne. On the night of Sunday, December 29th, Roosevelt pressed his case for aid to Britain in a fireside chat, the 16th of his presidency. With his re-election achieved, he now felt able to speak more freely about the war than thus far had been the case. He used the word Nazi for the first time, and described America as the arsenal of democracy, a phrase suggested by Harry Hopkins. "No man can tame a tiger into a kitten by stroking it," Roosevelt said. "There can be no appeasement with ruthlessness." If Britain were to be defeated, the unholy alliance of Germany, Italy, and Japan, the Axis would prevail, and all of us, in all the Americas, would be living at the point of a gun. A Nazi gun, he specified later in the speech. Hopkins had also urged him to leaven his talk with something optimistic. Roosevelt settled on this: "I believe that the Axis powers are not going to win this war. I base that belief on the latest and best information." As it happened, that latest and best information was merely his own instinct that his Lend-Lease plan not only would pass in Congress, but also would change the balance of the war in Britain's favour. Speechwriter Robert Sherwood called it Roosevelt's own private confidence that Lend-Lease would go through, and his certainty that this measure would make Axis victory impossible. Millions of Americans heard the broadcast, and so did millions of Britons, at 3:30 in the morning. In London, however, there was a good deal of distraction. That night, possibly in hopes of blunting the power of Roosevelt's planned fireside chat, the Luftwaffe launched one of its biggest raids thus far. The raid targeted London's financial district, known as the City. Whether the intent truly was to counter Roosevelt's broadcast is unclear, but other elements of its timing were deliberate. The bombers came on a Sunday night, during Christmas week, when all city offices, shops, and pubs would be closed, thus ensuring that few people would be around to spot and extinguish falling incendiaries. The Thames was at low tide, thereby limiting the supply of water to fight fires. It was also a night with no moon. The astronomical new moon had occurred the night before, all but guaranteeing little or no resistance from the RAF. The Luftwaffe's fire starter group, KGR 100, guided precisely by radio beacons, dropped incendiaries to light the target and high-explosive bombs to destroy water mains and expose more fuel to the resulting fires. A brisk wind intensified the conflagration, producing what became known as the Second Great Fire of London, the first having occurred in 1666. The raid caused 1,500 fires and destroyed 90% of the city. 24 incendiaries landed on St. Paul's Cathedral. With its dome at first obscured by smoke from the surrounding fires, the cathedral was feared lost. It survived with relatively little damage. The raid was otherwise so effective that RAF planners adopted the same tactics for future fire raids against German cities. In Berlin, Joseph Goebbels, writing in his diary, gloated over the attack. But first he addressed Roosevelt's fireside chat. "Roosevelt," he wrote, "makes a scurrilous speech aimed against us, in which he slanders the Reich and the movement in the most boorish fashion and calls for the most extensive support for England, in whose victory he firmly believes. A model of democratic distortion. The Führer still has to decide what to do about it. I would be in favour of a really tough campaign, of finally pulling no punches toward the USA. We are not getting far at present. One must defend oneself sometime, after all." With evident satisfaction, he turned next to the Luftwaffe and its recent successes. "London trembles under our blows," he wrote. The American press, he contended, were stunned and impressed. "If only we could keep our bombing on this scale for 4 weeks running," he wrote, "then things would look different. Apart from this, there are heavy shipping losses, successful attacks on convoys, and so on. London has nothing to smile about at the moment, that is for sure." On that score, Churchill begged to differ. The timing of the Great Fire Raid, in terms of sparking American sympathy, was perfect, as Alexander Cadogan observed in his diary. "This may help us enormously in America at a most critical moment. Thank God, for all their cunning and industry and efficiency, the Germans are fools." Death and damage aside, Churchill was thrilled with Roosevelt's fireside chat. On New Year's Eve, he met with Beaverbrook and his new Foreign Secretary, Anthony Eden, to craft a response. Churchill's senior-most finance minister, Kingsley Wood, Chancellor of the Exchequer, was also present. The cable began, "We are deeply grateful for all you said yesterday." But Churchill, as much as any man alive, understood that at this point Roosevelt's speech was just a collection of well-chosen words. It raised many questions. "Remember, Mr. President," he dictated, "we do not know what you have in mind, or exactly what the United States is going to do, and we are fighting for our lives." He warned of the financial pressures bearing down on England, with many supplies on order as yet unpaid for. "What would be the effect upon the world situation if we had to default in payments to your contractors who have their workmen to pay? Would not this be exploited by the enemy as a complete breakdown in Anglo-American cooperation? Yet a few weeks' delay might well bring this upon us." In the back of her diary, on blank pages allocated for notes and addenda to earlier entries, Mary quoted books, songs, and her father's speeches, and wrote out snippets of doggerel. She kept a list of the dozens of books she had read in 1940, which included Hemingway's A Farewell to Arms, Du Maurier's Rebecca, and Dickens's The Old Curiosity Shop, which she started but did not finish. "Just couldn't take that ruddy little Nell and her old grandpop," she wrote. She also read Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, noting, "I thought it sounded bloody." She wrote out the lyrics of a song. "A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square," the lover's anthem of the day, recorded, most recently, on December 20th, 1940, by the American singer Bing Crosby. One portion, as Mary remembered it, "The moon was shining up above. Poor, puzzled moon, he wore a frown. How could he know we were so in love that the whole darned world seemed upside down?" In Berlin, Joseph Goebbels worked a full day, then drove to his country home on the Bodensee, a lake north of the city, through a savage snowstorm. The snow, the snugness of the house, despite its 70 rooms, and the fact that it was New Year's Eve, in Germany, Silvester, put him in a reflective mood. "Sometimes I hate the big city," he wrote in his diary that night. "How beautiful and cozy it is out here. Sometimes I would like to never have to go back. The children are waiting for us at the door with hurricane lanterns. The snowstorm rages outside. All the better to chat by the fireside. It troubles my conscience that we have things so good out here." In the cabinet war rooms in London, John Colville handed a glass of champagne to his fellow private secretary, John Martin, this after both had consumed multiple brandies served by Pug Ismay. They climbed to the roof, the night black and nearly moonless, and toasted the new year. As of midnight, German raids over London alone in 1940 had killed 13,596 citizens and caused serious injury to another 18,378. And more was yet to come, including the single worst raid of all. 1941. Part 5. The Americans. January to March. Chapter 70. Secrets. The first 6 days of January were cold in a way that was atypical for the British Isles. At West Linton, near Edinburgh, Scotland, temperatures stayed below freezing from January 1st through the 6th. Temperatures tumbled to 6 degrees below 0 Fahrenheit in the English hamlet of Huffle. Snow fell at intervals throughout the month, with accumulations of 15 inches in Birmingham and drifts near Liverpool up to 10 feet deep. Powerful gales scoured the countryside, bringing winds that gusted to over 70 miles an hour. One gust tore through the port of Holyhead, Wales, at 82. In London, the wind and cold made for icy streets and produced miserable conditions for the many Londoners whose homes had been perforated by shrapnel and lacked heat and window glass. Even Claridge's was uncomfortable, its heating system unable to cope with such depths of cold. One guest, General Lee, the American military attaché, reported on January 4th that his rooms are like an icebox, though a coal fire eventually provided warmth. Snow fell on the night of January 6th, obscuring for a time the jagged remains of obliterated homes and turning London beautiful. "What a nice wintry morning this was," General Lee wrote in his journal the next day. "When I arose and looked out of my window, which is up pretty high, I could see all the streets and roofs covered with clean, white snow." The view over London evoked for him a Christmas card depicting a snow-covered city in Central Europe, with its chimney pots and angles picked out in black against the white snow coverlet and the grey sky above. Beaverbrook resigned again, one of a number of vexations that inaugurated the new year for Churchill. This resignation came after he asked Beaverbrook to take on an additional job that he deemed crucial to Britain's survival. One of Churchill's top priorities was to increase imports of food, steel, and myriad other civilian and material supplies, whose delivery, owing to Germany's intensified U-boat attacks, was more endangered than ever. To better direct, coordinate, and increase the flow of materials, Churchill established an import executive, and decided the best man to run it was Beaverbrook, who had so radically increased the production of fighters for the RAF. On January 2nd, he offered Beaverbrook the chairmanship, with the idea that Beaverbrook would continue as Minister of Aircraft Production, but would expand his portfolio to oversee the government's 3 supply ministries. His hope was that here too, Beaverbrook would serve as a catalytic force, to prod them into producing a greater flow of goods and materials. The post would give Beaverbrook greater power, which he had long claimed to want, but it would also put him in the position of being, essentially, a committee chairman, and Beaverbrook, as Churchill well knew, loathed committees. Sensing that Beaverbrook might resist the idea, Churchill imbued his pitch with flattery and an uncharacteristic woe-is-me needfulness. "Nothing can exceed the importance of the tasks you are about to assume," Churchill began, in the apparent presumption that Beaverbrook would, of course, take the job. "I want to point out to you that I am placing my entire confidence and, to a large extent, the life of the state upon your shoulders." If Beaverbrook chose not to take the job, Churchill wrote, he himself would have to do it. "This would not be the best arrangement, as it is bound to distract my thought from the military side of our affairs," he wrote. "I mention this to you because I know how earnestly you wish to help me, and there is no way in which you can help me so much as in making a happy solution of our import, shipping, and transport problems." Beaverbrook was unmoved. Professing deep regret, he rejected the chairmanship and made it clear that his resignation also applied to the Ministry of Aircraft Production. "I am not a committee man," he wrote on January 3rd. "I am the cat that walks alone." He offered his own sad sack closing. "This letter does not need any answer. I will find my own way about." Churchill took Beaverbrook's resignation as a slight against both himself and England. For Beaverbrook to leave now would be a betrayal. His energy and rapacious ingenuity had driven aircraft production to levels that seemed nearly miraculous, and were crucial in helping the country to withstand Germany's aerial onslaught and Churchill to maintain his own confidence in ultimate victory. Moreover, Churchill needed him personally. His knowledge of political undercurrents, his counsel, and just generally his presence, which enlivened the day. "My dear Max," Churchill dictated on January 3rd, "I am very sorry to receive your letter. Your resignation would be quite unjustified, and would be regarded as desertion. It would in one day destroy all the reputation that you have gained, and turn the gratitude and goodwill of millions of people to anger. It is a step you would regret all your life." Again, Churchill struck a note of self-pity,
No minister has ever received the support which I have given you, and you know well the burden which will be added to my others by your refusal to undertake the great commission with which I sought to entrust you." He awaited Beaverbrook's reply. Churchill had further cause for annoyance. He had learned of two lapses in secrecy, and these troubled him. In one case, an American correspondent telegraphed secret information about the Vichy government to her newspaper, the Chicago Daily News. What made this especially galling for Churchill was that the reporter, Helen Kirkpatrick, had gleaned the information from a conversation during one of his own dinner parties at Ditchley, his full moon retreat, where the unwritten law against divulging country house confidences held sway. The secret that the Vichy government would not provide direct military assistance to Germany was divulged over dinner by a French pianist, Eve Curie, daughter of the famous physicist. "Mademoiselle Curie, who is a woman of distinction, should have had the good sense not to gossip about it at a country house party," Churchill wrote to Anthony Eden, now his foreign secretary. "Miss Helen Kirkpatrick has betrayed the confidence for journalistic profit. Both these women should be questioned by MI5 at the earliest moment, and their explanations obtained." He told Eden that Kirkpatrick should be ejected from the country immediately. "It is very undesirable to have a person of this kind scouting about private houses for copy, regardless of British interests." This, and a second incident involving the publication of secret aircraft details in an American aviation magazine, prompted Churchill to send a directive to Pug Ismay, as well as others, on the subject of secrecy in general. With the beginning of the new year, a new intense drive must be made to secure greater secrecy in all matters relating to the conduct of the war, he wrote. He ordered tighter limits on the circulation of secret materials, and on what kind of information was made available to reporters. "We are having trouble through the activities of foreign correspondents of both sexes," he wrote. "It must be remembered that everything said to America is instantly communicated to Germany, and that we have no redress." Churchill's ire about secrecy caused John Colville anxiety about his own diary, which, filled as it was with operational secrets and insights into Churchill's behaviour, would have been a prize for any German agent who happened across it. Colville well understood that the act of keeping so precise a record was very likely illegal. "The PM has circulated a minute about preserving the secrecy of documents, which suddenly makes me feel rather conscience-stricken about this diary," he wrote in it on New Year's Day. "I haven't the heart to destroy it, and shall compromise by keeping it locked up here, even more strictly than hitherto." As that first day of 1941 began to wane, Churchill invited Colville on a tour of the construction underway to bombproof the ceiling of the cabinet war rooms. So anxious was Churchill to get up among the girders and falsework that he decided to set off with only the flashlight in the top of his walking stick to guide them, and, Colville wrote, promptly sank up to his ankles in thick liquid cement. Most annoying of all, apart from falling bombs and torpedoed ships, was a preliminary report Churchill received from Mr. Justice Singleton on his inquiry into the comparative strengths of the RAF and the Luftwaffe. Churchill had hoped it would resolve the issue and end the bickering and sniping among the various parties involved. It did not. Singleton wrote that in the course of his investigation, he had spent 5 days hearing evidence about numbers of fighters, bombers, aircraft wastage, reserves, and planes used as trainers. The document he submitted on that Friday, January 3rd, was merely an interim report, interim because he, too, was flummoxed. "At one time," he wrote in his opening paragraph, "I hoped that some measure of agreement might be reached, but it now seems unlikely that there will be agreement on the main factors." He accepted the Prof's reasoning, put forth the previous spring, that the German experience of aerial warfare, losses, reserves, rates of new production, could not be all that different from the British experience, and that therefore it was crucial first to know exactly what the British experience was. But precise numbers were elusive. Even after his painstaking analysis, more than 3,000 RAF planes remained unaccounted for. Singleton was unable to provide an accurate portrait of the British Air Force, let alone the German, nor was he able to bring into agreement the figures put forth by various ministries. I feel it will be extraordinarily difficult to arrive at any figure of German strength, he wrote. I can say no more at this stage than that I do not think it is as high as claimed by Air Staff Intelligence. Churchill found this deeply unsatisfying and exasperating, especially the failure of the Air Ministry to keep accurate records of its own aircraft. Singleton continued his investigation, as yet more conflicting numbers came into his possession. Beaverbrook stood fast. With a schoolboy's petulance, he told Churchill on Monday, January 6th, that he had never wanted to be a minister in the first place. "I did not want to join the government," he wrote. "The place in the cabinet was undesired, and was indeed resisted by me." He reiterated his rejection of the new chairmanship and his resignation as Minister of Aircraft Production. "It is because my usefulness has come to an end. I have done my job. The ministry," he wrote, "is better off without me." He thanked Churchill for his support and friendship, and closed the letter with a metaphoric hanky in hand. "On personal grounds," he wrote, "I hope you will permit me to see you sometimes, and to talk with you occasionally on the old terms." This was too much. "I have not the slightest intention of letting you go," Churchill wrote in reply. "I should feel myself struck a most cruel blow if you were to persist in so morbid and unworthy an intention." In places, Churchill's letter read more like the missive of a forsaken lover than a prime ministerial communication. "You have no right, in the height of a war like this, to put your burdens on me," he wrote. "No one knows better than you how much I depend on you for counsel and comfort. I cannot believe that you will do such a thing." He suggested that if Beaverbrook's health required it, he should take a few weeks to recuperate. "But abandon the ship now? Never." At midnight, Churchill again wrote to Beaverbrook, this time in longhand, and summoning the judgment of history. "You must not forget, in the face of petty vexations, the vast scale of events and the brightly lighted stage of history upon which we stand." He closed by quoting a remark that Georges Danton, a leader of the French Revolution, made to himself just before being guillotined in 1794. "Danton, no weakness." This skirmish with Beaverbrook was mostly stage combat. Having been friends for so long, they knew well how to jolt each other's composure and when to stop. This was one reason Churchill liked having Beaverbrook in his government and found such value in his near-daily presence. Beaverbrook was never predictable. Exasperating, yes, but always a source of energy and cold-eyed clarity, with a mind like an electric storm. Both men took a certain delight in dictating letters to each other. To both, it was like acting. Churchill strutting about in his gold dragon night clothes and jabbing the air with a dead cigar, savouring the sound and feel of words. Beaverbrook, like a knife thrower at a carnival, hurling whatever cutlery came to hand. The physical character of the resulting letters revealed the men's contrapuntal natures. Where Churchill's paragraphs were long and precisely worded, full of complex grammatical structures and historical allusions, in one note to Beaverbrook he used the word ichthyosaurus. Each of Beaverbrook's paragraphs was a single brief knife thrust, serrated with short, crisp words, not so much savoured as sputtered. The truth is that they both enjoyed it, and of course neither found the writing, or usually the dictating, of letters laborious, wrote A.J.P. Taylor, Beaverbrook's biographer. Beaverbrook liked parading his troubles, and liked still more winding up with a display of emotional attachment which, for the moment, while he was dictating the letter, he really felt. That first week of 1941 ended on a more positive note, with Churchill, at 2 a.m. on Tuesday, January 7th, climbing into bed in good spirits. More good news had come from Libya, where British forces were continuing to batter the Italian army. And Roosevelt, on Monday evening, early Tuesday in England, gave his State of the Union address, in which he presented his Lend-Lease plan to Congress, declaring that the future and the safety of our country and of our democracy are overwhelmingly involved in events far beyond our borders. He described a world to come that would be founded upon four essential human freedoms: speech, worship, and freedom from want and fear. Churchill recognized that a long fight lay ahead to secure passage of the Lend-Lease Bill, but he was heartened by Roosevelt's clear and public declaration of sympathy for Britain. Even better, Roosevelt had decided to send a personal emissary to London, who was due to arrive in a few days. At first, the man's name drew a blank. Harry Hopkins. On hearing it, Churchill asked pointedly, "Who?" Now, however, he understood that Hopkins was so close a confidant of the president that he lived in the White House, in a second-floor suite that had once served as Abraham Lincoln's office, just down the corridor from the president's own quarters. Churchill's aide, Brendan Bracken, called Hopkins the most important American visitor to this country we have ever had, and deemed him capable of influencing Roosevelt more than any living man. When Churchill did at last go to bed that night, it was with a great deal of satisfaction and optimism. He was smiling as he snuggled beneath the bedclothes, Colville wrote in his diary, and had the grace for once to apologize for keeping me up so late. For Pamela Churchill, the year began on a bittersweet note. She missed Randolph. "Oh, I wish you were here to cuddle me," she told him in a letter on New Year's Day. "I would be so happy then. I get panicky here alone and think if you are away long enough, you will forget me, and I can't bear it. Please try not to forget me, Randy." She told him as well that a special gas mask had arrived for baby Winston. "He goes into it entirely," she said, adding that she planned soon to attend a lecture on poison gas to be given at the local hospital. Beaverbrook stayed on as Minister of Aircraft Production, but he did not become chairman of the Import Executive. Neither did Churchill, despite his threat to martyr himself by doing so. Chapter 71. The 11:30 Special. The man who walked into 10 Downing Street on the morning of Friday, January 10th, appeared to be unwell. His complexion was sallow, his overall aspect one of fragility and wear, the effect amplified by a very large overcoat. Pamela Churchill noticed that he seemed never to take the coat off. She was shocked by his appearance at their first meeting, her impression of ill health reinforced by the crumpled, unlit cigarette he held in his mouth. The day before, upon arriving at the seaplane port at Poole, 100 or so miles from London, he had been so exhausted that he had been unable to remove his seatbelt. He was as unlike one's picture of a distinguished envoy as it was possible to be, wrote Pug Ismay. He was deplorably untidy. His clothes looked as though he was in the habit of sleeping in them, and his hat as though he made a point of sitting on it. He seemed so ill and frail that a puff of wind would blow him away. Yet this was Harry Hopkins, the man Churchill would later describe as playing a decisive part in the war. Hopkins was 50 years old, and now served as Roosevelt's personal advisor. Before this point, he had led three major programs of Roosevelt's Depression-era New Deal, including the Works Progress Administration, or WPA, which put millions of unemployed Americans to work. Roosevelt named him Secretary of Commerce in 1938, a post he held well into 1940, despite declining health. Surgery for stomach cancer had left him plagued by a mysterious suite of ailments that, in September 1939, led his doctors to give him only a few weeks to live. He rallied, and on May 10, 1940, the day Churchill became Prime Minister, Roosevelt invited him to stay at the White House. The arrangement became permanent. "His was a soul that flamed out of a frail and failing body," Churchill wrote. "He was a crumbling lighthouse from which there shone the beams that led great fleets to harbour." All this flaming and beaming would come later, however. First, before meeting Churchill, Hopkins got a tour of 10 Downing Street, with Brendan Bracken as his guide. The famed Prime Ministerial residence was so much smaller and less imposing than the White House, and seemed much the worse for wear.
"Number 10 Downing is a bit down at the heels, because the Treasury next door has been bombed more than a bit," Hopkins wrote in a message to Roosevelt later that day.
Bomb damage marked every floor. Most of the windows had been blown out, and workers were busy throughout making repairs. Bracken led Hopkins downstairs to the new armored dining room in the basement and poured him a glass of sherry. At length, Churchill arrived. A rotund, smiling, red-faced gentleman appeared, extended a fat but nonetheless convincing hand, and wished me welcome to England, Hopkins told Roosevelt. A short black coat, striped trousers,
A clear eye and a mushy voice was the impression of England's leader as he showed me, with obvious pride, the photographs of his beautiful daughter-in-law and grandchild. This last was a reference to Pamela and young Winston. The lunch was simple but good, served by a very plain woman who seemed to be an old family servant. Soup, cold beef. I didn't take enough jelly to suit the PM, and he gave me some more. Green salad, cheese and coffee, a light wine and port. He took snuff from a little silver box. He liked it. Right off, Hopkins addressed a matter that had pinched relations between America and Britain. I told him there was a feeling in some quarters that he, Churchill, did not like America, Americans or Roosevelt, Hopkins recalled. Churchill denied it emphatically and blamed Joseph Kennedy for promulgating so incorrect an impression. He directed a secretary to retrieve the telegram he had sent to Roosevelt the previous fall, in which he congratulated the president on his re-election, the one Roosevelt had never answered or acknowledged. This initial awkwardness was quickly eclipsed, as Hopkins explained that his mission was to learn all he could about Britain's situation and needs. The conversation ranged wide, from poison gas to Greece to North Africa. John Colville noted in his diary that Churchill and Hopkins were so impressed with each other that their tête-à-tête did not break up till nearly 4 o'clock. It was getting dark. Hopkins left for his hotel, Claridge's. With the moon nearly full, Churchill and his usual weekend entourage set off for Ditchley, where Hopkins was to join them the next day, Saturday, to dine and sleep. Colville and Bracken drove to Ditchley together and discussed Hopkins. It was Bracken who had first realized how important Hopkins was to Roosevelt. As they drove and chatted, visibility diminished. Even on clear nights, driving was difficult because of the blackout, with headlamps reduced to slits of light. But now an icy mist descended, Colville wrote, and we collided with a fish and chips wagon which burst into flames. Nobody was hurt, and we arrived safely at Ditchley. It was a fitting punctuation point for a day of heartbreak for Colville. While Churchill had been having lunch with Hopkins, Colville had been dining with his beloved Gay Murchison at the Carlton Grill in London. By coincidence, this was the 2-year anniversary of his first proposal to marry her. I tried to be reasonably aloof and not too personal, he wrote, but the conversation soon veered into philosophical approaches to leading one's life, and thus into more intimate realms. She looked lovely, sophisticated. She wore a silver fox. Her hair hung below her shoulders. She wore too much rouge, however, Colville noted with satisfaction, his accustomed means of easing the pain of her unattainability by noting her imperfections. Certainly she was not the Gay of January 10, 1939, he wrote, and I do not think the influence of Oxford has improved her. After lunch they went to the National Gallery, where they met Elizabeth Montagu, Betts, and Nicholas Nico Henderson, the man rumoured to have captured Gay's heart. Colville sensed a strong connection between Nico and Gay, and this raised in him a queer nostalgia, which he likened to jealousy. I went back to number 10 and tried to think how immaterial it all was in comparison with the great issues that I see daily there, but it was no good. Love dies slowly with me, if at all, and I felt sick at heart. Mary Churchill did not join the family at Ditchley. She planned instead to spend the weekend with a friend, Elizabeth Wyndham, the adopted daughter of Lord and Lady Leconfield, at Petworth House, their baroque country home in the South Downs region of West Sussex, southwest of London. A mere 14 miles from the Channel coast, this was invasion country. Mary planned to take a train to London first, do a little shopping with her former nanny, Marriott White, then catch a second train to the southwest. Looking forward to it so much, she wrote in her diary. At Chequers, the prison room was cold, the day outside laced with ice and very dark. Winter mornings always were dark at this latitude, but a change in how Britain kept time during the war made the mornings darker than ever. The previous fall, the government had invoked double British summertime to save fuel and give people more time to get to their homes before the blackout began each day. The clocks had not been turned back in the fall, as per custom, and yet would still be turned forward again in the spring. This created 2 extra hours of usable daylight during the summer, rather than just 1, but also ensured that winter mornings would be long, black, and depressing,
a condition that drew frequent complaints in civilian diaries. Wrote Clara Milburn, the diarist from Balsall Common near Coventry, "It is so dreadfully dark in the mornings that it seems hopeless to get up early and barge about, unable to see to do anything properly." Snug in the dark and cold, Mary overslept. She had expected someone to wake her, but no one had. She felt poorly. The roads were pale with ice. Bomb damage along the regular route required a time-consuming detour. She reached the station just in time for her train. This was her first visit to London since August, and she arrived feeling strange, country cousinish and very flustered, she wrote. In the intervening months, the city had been transmogrified through the dark magic of bombs and fire, but was still familiar to her. "And as I drove through the well-remembered streets and saw the scars and wounds, I felt I loved London very deeply. Shorn of her smartness, in wartime attire, I suddenly loved her very much." It evoked for her Proustian memories of how the city had moved her in the past. A bicycle ride on a hot summer afternoon through Hyde Park, when she paused on a bridge and watched people in the boats below. A view of the rooftops of Whitehall, rising above the trees in the evening sun like distant domes of a magic city. And a moment when she admired the perfect beauty of a tree beside the lake in St. James's Park. She made a brief stop at the No. 10 Annex, Churchill's new flat above the Cabinet War Rooms, where she marvelled at how homey her mother had made the place, waving her magic wand, as Mary put it, over rooms that previously had been mundane offices. Clementine had the walls painted in pale hues and filled the rooms with well-lit paintings and the family's own furniture. The flat straddled a passage that ran between government offices, and here, Mary wrote in a memoir, embarrassed officials would often encounter Winston, robed like a Roman emperor in his bath towel, proceeding, dripping, from his bathroom across the main highway to his bedroom. Mary reached Petworth early that afternoon and found a large party underway, with many young friends and strangers on the scene, both male and female. She judged her friend Elizabeth now to be silly and affected, adding, "I don't really like her." She was delighted, however, with Elizabeth's mother, Violet, who was renowned for leading the charge into new kingdoms of fashion. Violette, sick, was in excellent form, dressed in a pale blue V-necked jumper, loaded with jewellery and wearing scarlet corduroy slacks. Many of the guests left to see a movie, but Mary, still under the weather, decided to sequester herself in her assigned room. Later, rejuvenated by tea, she dressed for the night's ball. "I wore my new cherry red with the silver embroidered belt and diamond paste earrings." First came a dinner party, then the dance, which she deemed heavenly, positively pre-war. She danced with a Frenchman, Jean-Pierre Montaigne. "I felt incredibly gay. I waltzed with Jean-Pierre incovertly, wildly and very fast. Great fun. I missed only a few dances." She got to bed at 4:30 a.m., footsore and weary but very happy, and quite ill. At Ditchley on Saturday, the Churchills and the estate's owners, Ronald and Nancy Tree, prepared a gleaming evening for their guest of honour, the American emissary Harry Hopkins. Assorted other guests arrived, among them Oliver Littleton, president of the Board of Trade. "Dinner at Ditchley takes place in a magnificent setting," John Colville wrote in his diary that Saturday night. "The only illumination was candlelight, with candles mounted on the walls and in a large chandelier overhead. The table is not over-decorated, four gilt candlesticks with tall yellow tapers and a single gilt cup in the centre. Dinner itself was lavish, the food in keeping with the surroundings," Colville judged, though he guessed that the meal was less elaborate than would have been the case before a recent campaign against overfeeding by the Ministry of Food. After dinner, Nancy and Clementine and the other female guests left the dining room. Over cigars and brandy, Hopkins unveiled a capacity for charm that belied his death's door appearance. He praised Churchill for his speeches and said they played very well in America. At one cabinet meeting, he said, Roosevelt had even directed that a radio be brought into the room so that everyone could hear an example of his fine rhetoric. The PM, Colville wrote, was touched and gratified. Thus inspired and warmed by the brandy, Churchill unfurled his sails and embarked on a monologue in which he recounted the life and death saga of the war as it had unfolded thus far, as candlelight glinted in the brandy-moist eyes of his guests. At length he turned to the matter of Britain's war aims and the world of the future. He presented his vision of a United States of Europe, with Britain as its architect. He might have been speaking before the House of Commons, rather than to a small group of men fogged by cigars and alcohol in a quiet country house.
"We seek no treasure," Churchill said. "We seek no territorial gains. We seek only the right of man to be free. We seek his right to worship his God, to lead his life in his own way, secure from persecution. As the humble labourer returns from his work when the day is done and sees the smoke curling upwards from his cottage home in the serene evening sky, we wish him to know that no rat-tat-tat-tat," here Churchill knocked loudly on the table, "of the secret police upon his door will disturb his leisure or interrupt his rest." He said Britain sought only government by popular consent, freedom to say whatever one wished, and the equality of all people in the eyes of the law. But war aims, other than these, we have none. Churchill stopped. He looked at Hopkins. "What will the President say to all this?"
Hopkins paused before answering. Shards of twisty candlelight sparked off the crystal and silver. His silence lasted so long as to become uncomfortable, nearly a minute, which in that intimate context seemed a very long time. Clocks ticked. A fire hissed and seethed in the hearth. The candle flames did their quiet Levantine dance. At last, Hopkins spoke.
"Well, Mr. Prime Minister," he began in an exaggerated American drawl, "I don't think the President will give a damn for all that."
Privy Councillor Oliver Littleton felt a jolt of anxiety, as he noted in his diary.
Had Churchill miscalculated?
Heavens alive, he thought. It's gone wrong. Hopkins let his second pause linger.
"You see," he drawled, "we're only interested in seeing that the goddamn son of a bitch Hitler gets licked."
Loud laughter, amplified by relief, convulsed the table. Mrs. Tree entered and gently but resolutely directed Churchill and the rest of the group toward the Ditchley Home Cinema for a movie, a film released the prior year called Brigham Young, in which Dean Jagger played the Mormon leader and Tyrone Power one of his followers. The film's premiere in Salt Lake City had caused a sensation, drawing 215,000 people at a time when the city's population totaled 150,000. Next came German newsreels, including one that featured the March 18, 1940 meeting between Hitler and Mussolini at the Brenner Pass in the Alps between Austria and Italy, which, with all its salutes and its absurdity, Colville wrote, was funnier than anything Charlie Chaplin produced in The Great Dictator. Churchill and his guests retired at 2 a.m. That night in London, during an intense German air raid, a bomb struck the Bank underground station, killing 56 of the people sheltering within, throwing some in front of an approaching train. The dead ranged in age from 14 to 65, and included a police officer named Beagles, a 60-year-old Russian national named Fanny Ziff, and a 16-year-old with the grimly apt name of Harry Roast. South of the Thames, the air was infused with the scent of incinerated coffee, as 100 tons of it burned in a warehouse in Bermondsey. This was the added cruelty of air raids. In addition to killing and maiming, they destroyed the commodities that kept England alive, and that already were tightly rationed. In the week that ended, Sunday, January 12th, bombs and fire destroyed 25,000 tons of sugar, 730 tons of cheese, 540 tons of tea, 288 tons of bacon and ham, and perhaps most barbaric of all, an estimated 970 tons of jams and marmalade. On Sunday night at Ditchley, Churchill kept Hopkins up even later, until 4:30 a.m. Hopkins wrote about the night in a letter to Roosevelt, which he composed on demure squares of Claridge's stationery. The letter's contents would have delighted the Prime Minister. "The people here are amazing from Churchill down," Hopkins told Roosevelt, "and if courage alone can win, the result will be inevitable. But they need our help desperately, and I'm sure you will permit nothing to stand in the way." Churchill, he wrote, held sway over the entire British government and understood every aspect of the war.
I cannot emphasize too strongly that he is the one and only person over here with whom you need to have a full meeting of minds.
Hopkins emphasized the urgency of the moment. This island needs our help now, Mr. President, with everything we can give them. In a second note, Hopkins emphasized the sense of impending threat that pervaded Churchill's government. The most important single observation I have to make is that most of the cabinet and all of the military leaders here believe that invasion is imminent. They expect it before May 1st, he wrote, and believe it will certainly be an all-out attack, including the use of poison gas and perhaps some other new weapons that Germany may have developed. He pressed Roosevelt to act soon. I cannot urge too strongly that any action you may take to meet the immediate needs here must be based on the assumption that invasion will come before May 1st. That Churchill saw poison gas as a grave and real threat was evident in his insistence that Hopkins be issued a gas mask and a helmet, his tin hat. Hopkins wore neither. From a sartorial perspective, this was prudent. He and his immense overcoat already resembled something an American farmer might stick in a field to scare away birds. Hopkins told Roosevelt, "The best I can say for the hat is that it looks worse than my own and doesn't fit. The gas mask I can't get on, so I am all right." Upon finishing this note, Tuesday morning, Hopkins set out through the icy cold to meet Churchill, Clementine, Pug Ismay, American Observer Lee, and Lord and Lady Halifax for a journey to the far north, to the British naval base at Scapa Flow, off the northern tip of Scotland. There, the Halifaxes and General Lee were to board a battleship bound for America. The journey to Scapa was itself part of Churchill's effort to win Hopkins to Britain's cause. Ever since his arrival, Hopkins had become Churchill's near-constant companion, a broken shadow in an oversized coat. Hopkins realized later that, in his first 2 weeks in England, he had spent a dozen evenings with the Prime Minister. "Churchill scarcely let him out of his sight," wrote Pug Ismay. Still not wholly versed in the geographic idiosyncrasies of London, Hopkins made his way toward what he thought was King's Cross Station, where Churchill's train would be waiting. He had been warned to refer to the train only as the 11:30 special, to keep Churchill's presence a secret. The train was indeed waiting at King's Cross. Hopkins was not. He had gone to Charing Cross instead.